Hey, this is ArtSpeak Radio. I'm Maria Vasquez Boyd, your host, and we have a house full of Kansas City Art Institute alumni and educators today, and we're going to have a terrific discussion with John Ferry, Jonah Criswell, Brett Chenoweth, and Hector Casanova. We're going to find out about their experiences at the Art Institute and what it's like to be there now as instructors. And the second half, we have Suzanne Gunther, who is a photographer. She hails from Wichita, Kansas, but now lives in Germany. Over the last couple of weeks, she was here just briefly to photograph over 50, maybe close to 70 artists here in Kansas City, just photographing the creative community and talking with them and recording some audio file with them. So we'll hear an interview with her in the second half. Right now, I want to introduce you to John Ferry. John received his BFA, his degree from Kansas City Art Institute, and his MFA from School of Visual Arts, New York. He teaches illustration and drawing and painting at the Art Institute and has taught at the Maryland Institute College of Art, where he won a Trustees Award for Excellence in Teaching. Now, his work has appeared in numerous corporate collections, including Sprint, the Stowers Institute and H&R Block, the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, the Wichita Center for the Arts, and the Nerman Museum of Contemporary Art. They all have his paintings in their permanent collection. Now, he's been published in New American Paintings, Society of Illustrators, and International Painting Annual, which was most recently. Now, John lives and paints in Prairie Village, Kansas, with his wife, Amy, and two daughters, Catherine and Paige. According to Will Hipps, he writes, Ferry's works reveal the aesthetic beauty of the overlooked and forgotten urban environment and brilliantly portrays the cycle of change in our cities. He's from the Art Museum and Gallery. He's a gallery director at Kennesaw State University. In John Ferry's artist statement, he likes this statement by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. We wouldn't be creative at all if we didn't have boundaries to deal with. Welcome, my friend. Welcome, John Ferry.
Thank you for having me, Maria.
You bet. You know, your work still stands, and it's so lush and beautiful. We're just all better for you creating these wonderful pieces of work. So thank you.
Thank you.
You know, let's get talking about what it was like as a student for you at the Art Institute. Where did you actually come from? Where did you live?
Well, you know, I kind of have a romantic story about it, and I won't go too long, but my father taught at a university called Millikan University in Decatur, Illinois, and during that time, they had tuition exchange with certain schools, and my high school art teacher, who's no longer with us, but I love very much, his name was Stephen Spangler, and his brother lived in Kansas City, and he looked at the list of schools that I could attend and have this tuition exchange. He said, this is a really good school. You need to go there, take your college day, look at it. And that year they had Portfolio Day on October 30th, 1988, and I remember that because it was my birthday. And my parents and I drove down the day before from Decatur. It's about a six-hour drive. And I remember just walking on to the campus and Pam Holzel greeting us, mm-hmm. and they had the sculpture chair, these chairs or swings hanging from the trees from an assignment, and going through all the departments. And I just, every assignment looked like so much fun to me. And we, mm-hmm. we were joking about art being fun earlier. But yeah. At that time, you know, I just really fell in love with the school. And I'm not joking when I say this. I mean, I just knew this is where I wanted mm-hmm. to go and where I wanted to be.
Yeah. And it's a fairly small college, and so it's really intimate, and you get more of a one-on-one.
Yeah. And it has been. I just got done reading Milton Katz's book about the school, and it's really stayed around 600 students for the majority of its, you know, 100, what are we going on, 130 years, maybe over that now?
I think so.
So 131.
So you went into the illustration department, right?
Correct.
But actually, I should back up. Foundations,
and you were a student. In fact, we didn't have classes together, yeah. but we were there yeah. at the same time.
I remember playing basketball with you,
yeah.
and it wasn't very fair.
I was the the one of the three people who actually liked sports at art school during that time.
Now, during your time there as a student, what were some of the things that you learned, not only through the department, but maybe from other students and professors in that? What was your experience?
You know, I had really good roommates all throughout school, and you know, success breeds success, and it's kind of like, I heard this analogy the other day. I think it's pretty good. Like, when two rams butt heads, they do it not necessarily to fight, but to get themselves stronger. And there, you know, there's a lot of having students with being around people with really solid work ethics and talent, but I believe more in the work ethic aspect than the talent. You know, you start surrounding yourself with those kinds of people, and that they'll teach you, you know, you just start learning about what you need to work on and, mm-hmm. and bringing, you know, what you need to work on and really putting the work in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just had a lot of great professors throughout my whole time there, mm-hmm. Through every department and foundation, starting with Steve Fleming, who.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever have Steve?
No, I didn't. No.
He was a great professor, and I took as many classes as I could from him. And mm-hmm. then, you know, through illustration, having Steve Mays, who's now our chair of our illustration program, I know Hector will probably talk about that too. They're really it can be a very nurturing school too. And yeah. I kind of believe in, you know, once you bring, you know, the work. I wasn't one who needed somebody to be hard on me or mm-hmm. tough, and you need mm-hmm. you know, I can do that to myself, but. I wanted to look at and listen to people and be influenced by
sure.
What they've learned.
So, is there one individual or just a collective support that inspired you during your education there? I mean, was it just the support in the arts community, or was there one person that sort of like, hey, John, you know?
I don't think there was just one. That was one great thing about the school, is having many professors, you know, even in my academic, who would take time or talk to you about whatever you had. So I don't know that I certainly did through junior high and high school before I got there with my teachers there. And I'm still close to Pat Myers, my junior high teacher, to this day. But, you know, I remember once an instructor brought in the Bay Area figurative art book, and he showed me a painting of Richard Diebenkorn Scissors, mm-hmm. and that did it. Mm-hmm. Like, that day mm-hmm. was a watershed moment. Just wow. like 12 by 12 inches. I painted bad scissors the rest of the day, you know, and went out and bought that book. But having those kinds of experiences were huge. Like, you know, you go to all these classes, and not every day is – you're going to have that groundbreaking moment, but you need to go through all of that to get to that one. And then when you have it, boy, you remember it.
Right. You know, and as you mentioned, Richard Diebenkorn, everyone's shaking their head. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So now as an instructor in the illustration department, does your experience as a student in illustration, have you learned something to take that back into the classroom as an educator?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And the good thing about illustration, you know, the way we do it changed. You know, the computer, certainly when I was in school, the computer, you know, we started with those Macosauruses with the little, I think they brought them in our freshman year, and I think we had like four color monitors by the end. So it was really a conventional time for illustration, and now it's digital. But you get away from how it's created, and you know, it's storytelling, and that will always mm-hmm. be in existence. Mm-hmm. You know, it started with mm-hmm. cave painting and storytelling. And so helping the students also, not just about the field, whether it's, you know, advertising or editorial, but figure out their stories and mm-hmm. how they want to tell their stories and do their work. And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't change. And dealing with people and art directors, that doesn't change either.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's... at one point, I think illustration went away, but then it was resurfaced, right?
Right.
How many years ago?
Well, we restarted the Pro Steve Mays, got together with Hector and Nathan Fox and myself a few times and put together the program, and it was resurrected in 2010. And that's when I came back to the Art Institute to teach.
Beautiful. You know, we're going to shift. And I would normally play music through a transition, but I just want to keep the energy going. And I'm going to shift over to Brett Chenoweth, who is an award-winning and internationally artist exhibiting from Kansas City here in Kansas City, Missouri. He earned a BFA in photography with a minor in art history from Washington University in St. Louis in 1986, and he got earned a BFA degree in painting from the Art Institute here in 1989. He also earned his master's degree of interdisciplinary studies in humanities from Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont in 1999. He's been painting and drawing in Kansas City, Vermont, and Maine all over. He reignited his love for photography while taking pictures for source material for his drawings. As the iPhone began to emerge as a valid and present vehicle for documentation, Brett now focuses on mobile photography as his primary tool for his work. Additionally, the iPad allows him to mix drawing, painting, and photography together with ease, essentially obliterating the boundaries between these media, taking Brett's work into new directions. Welcome, Brett Chenoweth.
Thank you. And that was Blair Schumann who wrote most of that, so I got to give him credit.
There you go. Yeah, Blair. Good old Blair. Well, and, you know, you were on the campus much earlier than when I was. No, we were there at the same time. We just did not know each other. Okay. Well, okay. Now I'm just making up things.
Yeah, but, go with it.
But so in the painting department, it was very different then versus now, right?
I think so. You know, coming back and forth and watching it, I was just talking to Jonah here about its changes where, you know, it was pretty abstract when we were there or when I was there.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Ron and Lester teaching and Warren. Mm-hmm. And then it went really figurative for a while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Jonah's telling me now, and I haven't paid much attention, but it's back to the more abstraction.
Really?
And you know, I think that's exciting.
Yeah, because I know actually in painting there were almost two schools. There was abstract, and then there was Wilbur Newald.
Yes,
you know, and you know his work is very beautiful, but you could tell which students studied with him and which you know were with the other instructors.
Right, there was a huge disparity there.
Yeah.
But it was what it was. I know when I first visited the painting department, you know, I noticed how much of an influence Lester had as well. So there was also that disparity. And then, you know, most of us fell in between all that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so now you've returned your teaching at the Art Institute.
Yeah, I'm teaching in the continuing studies program. And I have for since I moved back to Kansas City in 2003 or 4, I did do early college as well for a while, which was just a blast.
Yeah,
and it's different than teaching in a studio program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for like the continuing ed, I'm teaching basic
mm-hmm.
stuff,
mm-hmm.
and I'm teaching adults that don't have a lot of experience, give or take a few. The art history doesn't play as big of a role into it, but I try to bring that to the table as much as possible, certainly.
Sure.
But you know, it's how to mix paint, how to get it on the canvas.
But, you know, with continuing education, because, I mean, I've started some of those classes way back when,
mm-hmm.
it's just sort of a nice window to something, you know, much bigger. It's affordable, and people that want to be there to learn and to make art will be there.
Yes,
right?
Yes. And I actually like it. I like it. It's low-key, but it brings something to people that otherwise – it's an audience that often doesn't have that experience of art school. And so you're bringing a little of that back
mm-hmm.
with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that. It's reaching in a way a broader audience than – art school students.
And so although you still dabble with painting,
I still paint.
It's mostly digital?
I do a lot of digital. I'm painting, I'm doing more and more abstract painting again, but mm-hmm. I picked up a camera, like you said, for, also to photograph my daughter as well. Mm-hmm. And I realized that this, it had a lot of potential. And it was when I was back studying photography, I was not a techie. I didn't like any of that. I just wanted to point and shoot and make the art. I could do that with an iPhone so easily, and it was so immediate. And then I could get it on an iPad, and I could start drawing into it. I could start collaging with it, and it became really exciting for me. And, when I went from abstract painting to doing fairly narrative drawings. Mm-hmm. And I think both of those have now influenced what I'm doing with the photographic process. Mm-hmm. I also met a wonderful community of like-minded artists. It's a small little niche in the art world, but it's worldwide. And I co-founded with about 40 other artists a little group called New Era Museum out of Florence, Italy, that is propagating this stuff.
Yeah.
And, we've done some shows. And it's just really excited. And now we're also moving into analog, old school.
Wow.
So it's been a lot of fun. And it's, again, it's fairly low key.
Mm-hmm.
I got tired of the sort of the art world intensity, and I kind of dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having a lot more fun making stuff. Now, I attribute some of that to my kid.
Well, there's always that. I mean, really, honestly. And sometimes, and just teaching people, it just kind of opens up another way of thinking or working, right?
Right, right. I learn from students all the time, always have. Mm-hmm. I learn from the teaching. I learn from that give and take. And, and it's constantly evolving how I think about not only people but also art making and what I have to give.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes, it can influence my art too.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the digital media, you don't have what I miss about that is that you don't have the tactile. Do you find the same thing for yourself?
And that's why I paint and draw still.
Good.
But also, I've got an iPad Pro now, and I'm working with an Apple Pencil, and there's a good feeling there. I mean, I can draw pretty well, just like I'm drawing on paper now.
Wow.
So there is that tactile thing. Yeah, I miss getting my hands dirty sometimes, but paint takes care of that.
Oh, great. We're going to move next to, thank you, Brett.
Sure.
We're going to move next to Hector Casanova, who is also, he graduated from the Art Institute in 1998 with a double major in illustration and art history. He's been working as a fine and graphic artist for more than 15 years, doing work for collectors, magazines, and corporations nationally and abroad. He was a staff artist at the Kansas City Art, at the Kansas City Star, where he illustrated hundreds of articles and stories and won a handful of awards and accolades. His comics work includes Screamland with writer Harold Seip and The Lurkers with writer Steve Niles. And he also co-founded and operated the Green Door Gallery, which was an alternative art space here in Kansas City between 2000 and 2008. Most recently, his collaboration with Renee Cinderhouse for the exhibition Manifest Destiny at La Esquina was highlighted during the 2012 Fringe Festivals. Welcome, Hector Casanova.
Hi, Maria. It's a pleasure to be here again. Thanks.
You've just become a regular,
It's been a busy year. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I remember you coming into the illustration department, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, you brought a very large door that you had painted on.
Yeah, that sounds like something I would have done.
Yeah, and so as a student back at the illustration department, what is it like for you returning as an educator in the illustration department?
It's an honor, really, because in a way I feel like I set out to my goal in life was fairly simple, which was to make my living from making art,
right.
And then. Secondarily, but just as important, for that art to be somehow making the world better.
Mm-hmm.
I knew from since I was a student that I never wanted to use my talent to sell stuff that I would never want to buy, for example. Mm-hmm. So working for ad agencies and things like that was never something that I would contemplate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I managed to do that for the last 15 years, mm-hmm. and working in journalism, which I always felt very mm-hmm. happy and proud to be part of.
And also now on staff at the Art Institute, you have your students involved in and more community-related activities, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And that's really why it's such an honor to be able to be teaching now, is because after being out in the world for 15 years, beating my head against the world, it gets a little exhausting, and I started getting jaded and demoralized, and then being able, being back in an academic environment, it reconnects me with all the things that really make me feel passionate about art by seeing it in this younger generation, and then being able to kind of help them, help direct them mm-hmm. towards hopefully, successful careers, making the world better too.
And you still continue with your work. I mean, it's such a juggling act, to have family and work and, keep your art going, right?
Yes, we are all practicing professionals at the Art Institute, which basically means that the full-time job of teaching is just one of the full-time jobs that we have.
Yeah. So, Hector, what do you have coming up and on your calendar? I know everyone will return to the Art Institute to teach in a couple of weeks, but especially, I guess I'm asking in terms of your students in the mural project.
This last year, for the last two years, I've been working with students on a mural project. But that's usually only been a fall semester project. Mm-hmm. However, there's been some nice developments with that in the sense that I'm going to be passing it on to the Kansas City Public School District so that high school and middle school students are going to be taking over for the spring semester. So that's right. going to continue moving forward this spring semester.
Wow.
Meanwhile, I'll continue focusing with, other classes in the illustration department. We'll be doing comic books and, graphic form and other kind of required classes.
And recently, the illustration department came up with sort of a pairing students and artists, illustrators with the community. Can you talk about that?
Do you mean the mentorship program?
Yes.
Yes. Part of the curriculum in illustration is that all students have to do either an internship or a mentorship. And for the mentorship, they reach out to artists whose work they admire in the community, typically locally. Although we've had some students that have worked with out of town artists as well. And then they have a semester long project that the artists will kind of supervise them and give them regular feedback.
Yeah.
So that's been also really great.
And it was really well attended when I went last semester. And is it something that's going to be done in the future, yearly or?
We do this event called the Harvest every fall semester, and that's when all of the students will basically set up all of their work, and it'll be kind of like a shopping mall for. It's almost like a mutual dating show. artists and organizations that want interns or are interested in interns will come and look at students' work, and then students will see what the artists and organizations have to offer.
Yeah, I think I remember you likened it to speed dating.
Yes.
In a sense. Terrific. Thank you, Hector. We're going to move over to Jonah Criswell, who was born in Springfield, Missouri and raised in Pensacola, Florida. He attended the Art Institute from 2001 to 2005, where he earned a BFA in painting.
Yes.
Yeah. He graduated from the Pennsylvania State University School of Visual Art in 2008 with an MFA. And from 2008 to 2011, he worked at the Kansas City Art Institute's Office for Admissions. And he started teaching in the painting department in 2008, where he is currently an assistant professor of art. Welcome, Jonah.
Thank you so much for having me today.
You bet. You bet. So, what are some of the differences between then and now within the painting department?
Well, so one of the unique things that happened the summer that I graduated, they built the new painting building. So all the old was sort of torn down. And then, and it actually was really beautiful because the way that the faculty in the painting department are situated is that we're all around each other all the time. So we have lunch together. We see each other in the morning. We see each other when we're leaving. We work with our assistant, Alona Bernard. So we really are all one unit. And that collaborative environment has moved into the students as well. So you see this really empathetic, rigorous, and collaborative environment where all of the students, despite you know, previous generations seeing the difference between representation or abstraction, now we see it as a studio practice.
Wow, yeah.
And so it's really fulfilling, yeah.
Terrific. You know, how many, let me ask you, ballpark idea, number, how many students are in the painting department?
That's a good. It fluctuates from year to year. I would say around 70 to 90. So we have a pretty big group of people in the department, and it feels like a good gym. You walk in and you just feel a good energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what is currently? What is your work? What are you inspired by in your work? What are you doing currently within your work when you're not teaching?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I do a lot of drawings, and the drawings are of paintings that I've made, and so one of the lovely parts about this is that there's a reflexive quality to that. Mm-hmm. And what's nice is that, Warren Rosser, who was the chair for 28 and a half years, and then Julie Farstead, they really encourage you to teach from your studio. Mm-hmm. So the class that I'm offering in the spring, it's called Ecstatic Drawing. And it's about what happens when you have a semester to work on one or two large, time-consuming projects, which just comes directly out of the things that I make. And so it's a real commitment on the behalf of the students, and it's a pleasure to teach. So there's a really great reciprocal relationship between those two things. But I just had an exhibition in Germany, and so I got the work back like maybe 2 weeks ago, and it felt like, you know, my friends came back home. I pinned them up in the studio and invited all my colleagues in. And drawing has always been really important to me. Growing up, I did a lot of drawing. I grew up around my grandmother, who was, you know, painting and drawing. She was an illustrator for the local newspaper, and then she was doing paintings of wildlife on plates to sell them to make money for the family. So I'd grown up around a really heavy respect for drawing, and it's, you know, no accident that it's in my studio now.
Wow. You know, it's amazing what the power of art can do when you grow up, when you're surrounded with art. You know, I think sometimes, perhaps as creative people, maybe we take advantage of it. We just kind of don't really think about it. You know, John Ferry and I had a discussion out in the green room about that this show exists for the community to learn about creative people, artists and performers and writers and all that, because we're such an odd and rare breed, you know, it seems like. You know, John, you had talked about that when people say, you know, I make art. It must be fun. You know, when they find out that you're an instructor and an artist and a painter.
Right.
It must be
fun. Well, yeah, I got that out of I read something in a book called Art and Fear. By the way, if you want to teach, everybody should read The Art Spirit by Robert Henry.
Oh, my God, yeah. I think we all have that copy with us right now. It's just like the Bible.
With a few things. But, you know, there was something in that book I read once, and I get that, you know, people say, oh, you do art. That must be so much fun. It's a blessing. It's rewarding. It's great. At times it can be. But, you know, if I think it's something to the effect of, if you're a doctor and somebody talked about your biology course, that must be so much fun. Well, as if it's not working hard at the same time. Yeah. I mean, if you want to be great at something, it's a lot. It's hard work. You have to practice things that maybe aren't fun, actually. You know, to talk to a concert violinist about that.
You know, when your students come up to you and maybe they're sort of like distressed, or they're just not, they're unsure about where their work is going, what's some advice do you give your students in terms of, you know, careers, or, you know, my parents don't understand the work that I do? What is some advice that you can impart on our listeners, what you've mentioned to your students?
That's a really insightful question, because so much of my role as an educator is also to let the students understand that, that they are an inevitable force. So when they make 100 things, those 100 things will carry a kind of thumbprint across them that is unique to them. And so one of the things that I try to encourage them is to try to be as genuine and honest and curious in their work so that they can see themselves more clearly. And then that will allow them to make decisions about where they're going to place themselves in the world. And, you know, we see from the State of the Union last night that we're living in a world where there's going to be a lot of changes. And one of the things I think that artists are really great at is they're really wonderful at teaching themselves how to do things and reinventing themselves.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, that was the one thing I think I learned from the Art Institute more than anything else was that anything can happen and you have the power to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the students, I mean, the students that come out of there can do that.
Yeah.
They can roll with it.
Can I read one thing? I just finished this.
Sure.
It's a quick thing from Walter Sickert's A Free House. But I think what he wrote years ago is still timely today. And he said, a very special responsibility falls on teachers of the arts. They become the natural advisors of the parents as to whether a given student is sufficiently gifted to make it prudent for him to build his whole future on a prospect of making a living by the art. And then he goes on, he must be perpetually turned inside out and tested. And lastly, and I'm skipping ahead, there were a few things. Students must be examined, not against each other, which proves nothing, but against, as Auguste de Morgan used to say, against the subject. And I think he brings up some pretty good points about our responsibilities to the students and what to expect out of them and how to talk to them.
This is a loaded question. Is there life after art school?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
For me.
We come out thinking we can do anything. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a question that, you know, perhaps an individual might ask of themselves or their parents or, you know, where do you go from here? And I think the opportunities are, you know, infinite.
But by life, do you mean can you make a living at art or
make a living?
Yeah.
You know, showing your work. Can you make a dent in this place?
And I think that that's what really sets Kansas City apart from any other city that I lived in. And I lived in over a half dozen cities before I kind of settled in Kansas City. But Kansas City is so receptive. To artists, and it's really easy to be an artist and to get a foothold and to be able to make something happen. The city itself, for the last 15 years especially, has been going through this kind of like growing pains, but there's still a lot of fertile ground. It really, and that's kind of what's exciting about, you know, students graduating from art school, is that when you're in art school, they're in this kind of like insular bubble where everything is provided for them. They have facilities, they have networking, they have social connections, they have feedback. Anything that they want, they just, you know, they don't have to look far at all for it.
Right.
Once they're out, they have to go and look for all those things. But also they're likely to discover that all it takes is just wanting to do it. If you want to do it and you persevere, you can pretty much do anything you want in this city as far as the arts go.
Beautiful.
It just takes being pigheaded.
We're going to wind down here, and I want to mention that John Ferry, his website is johnferry.net.
Yes.
Anything to add to that, John?
No, but thank you so much for having me today.
Absolutely.
Well, I'll leave with one quote that Edward, it's a Goethe quote that Edward Hopper carried in his pocket, and I always say to my students, especially during figure drawing, look until you become fascinated, trust that you will see something. If you learn to wait, the objects will slowly sink into your consciousness and acquire a significance that can be measured in color and feeling.
Beautiful. Thank you, John.
Rocks.
And then next, we talk to Brett Chenoweth at brettchenoweth.com. Anything to add to that, Brett? Online work?
Everything I do, you can get from there.
Okay. Okay.
You know, it's kind of low key, but it's all there. And,
beautiful.
It's been a pleasure, Maria. It's been great to be here.
Anytime. Come back. So. Thank you. And then we have Hector Castanova. Hector, I like that you can keep up with his shenanigans through his Facebook page or his website. HectorCastanova.com, right?
Yes.
Okay, very good. And you'll be back to, well, all of you should be back, you know.
I think, yeah, we'd love to be back at some point. Thank you.
Very good. Mm-hmm. And Chriswell, JonahChriswell.com, yes?
Yes, yes.
Very good. Keep us posted of upcoming events or exhibitions and that sort of thing, and we'll be happy to have you back on anytime, honestly. So thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you, Maria. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be right back with ArtSpeak Radio. Thank you for tuning into ArtSpeak Radio. I'm Maria Vasquez Boyd, your host. Next up, we have Suzanne Gunter, who is an expat American photographer who's living in Germany, and she's been there since 2007. Late in life, she came to photography, but has been putting images in front of people in one form or another. She is self-taught and loves the freedom to experiment. And she writes, "In my first year of college, my painting instructor told me I was breaking rules by not covering the whole canvas." Rules and art? Suzanne Gunter was in town recently to photograph as many creative people in the Kansas City community and record their stories. She was here for 3 days, and she had just so many people come through her studio and meet with her and be photographed. So we're going to hear a recorded interview with her starting right now. I'm talking with Suzanne Gunter, who recently completed an ambitious photo shoot, Portraits of City Folk, here in Kansas City. The photo shoot is in support of a multimedia installation for Kansas City. The portraits are not just artists, musicians, and creatives, but all the people in and around the community. The broad theme is about connections of all kinds and those we often don't see. Suzanne took photographs of over 100 individuals in 3 days. So welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you. It's really good to be here.
Well, you know, I realize that you're originally from Wichita, and now you live in Kranzberg, Essen, Germany?
It's Kranzberg, and it's in the state of Hessen, and it's just 25 minutes northwest of Frankfurt. That's the town most people would know.
Well, we were so excited that you came back to Kansas City for this project. When did you decide to take on such an ambitious project, and what was your inspiration?
clinical madness. I took up photography several years ago. After moving to Germany, I found my medium. Mm-hmm. But before that, I'd lived in Kansas City on and off over many years, and got to know many of the people in the creative arts music scene here, performed burlesque and performed with the Porn Huskers.
Oh, yeah.
Steve Tulipana and crew. And
William Guilfoyle.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was kind of on the fringe of the creative community here, depending on who you asked, I suppose. But with the photo project, I wanted to bring my medium back and contribute to the community here that I'd admired and been partially a part of for so long. Mm-hmm. It stemmed originally from what people always say about Kansas City being so tightly woven. The degrees of separation are probably more like one or two. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do a portrait series in Kansas City, but I didn't want it just to be portraits, because there's a lot of photographers here that are already doing that and have been for a long time. I want it, and it just started growing in my mind, and I realized how much time I was going to have to spend here, and I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to photograph as many mm-hmm. people as I possibly can. It actually ended up closer to 70, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's still a pretty good number of people. So how did you set up for this project? You know, you had to find the location and get the call out for people to participate. How did that work for you?
Primarily through Facebook and using the connections that inspired the project in the first place. I have a cousin here in Kansas City, Michael Thomas Edmondson, and also a very good friend named Christina Ning. There were other people that helped get the word out too, but those two were the primary Pied Pipers for my project.
Yeah.
And I rented the space for the photo shoot, the studio, from Peregrine Honig.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a very key member of the creative scene in the Crossroads.
Right.
Most people know her name. She's done a lot to legitimize the scene, in my opinion, here in Kansas City. And honestly, I knew that if I was in that studio space, it was going to lend some credibility to this project that me being away for so long might have taken away from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wanted people to show up, and I think it helped.
So did it meet or exceed your expectations? Because you did get a lot of response, and,
mm-hmm,
and
I did.
People were really excited about it, and it's like, tell one person, and they told another. But what was your take on that?
I was really overwhelmed, floored. When I first started planning, it was a few months ago,
mm-hmm.
and I started talking about it. I created a group before I came to Kansas City, a couple of weeks to a month before I came. I used Facebook to create a group email and at first a closed group, just. Mm-hmm. Inviting the people I thought would be interested, but I opened it up after a while to more people. I think maybe after I got here, I'm not sure. But once it started and the people started showing up, because it was kind of a slow start to get everybody to schedule.
Yeah,
I said
I
it was
imagine.
Like hurting Tinkerbell in a thunderstorm to get these creatives, these
yeah.
people that don't necessarily operate on a normal schedule to come.
Know exactly what you mean.
Right. but once they started showing up, you're a good example. And seeing what this meant to people, my focus changed a little bit.
Hmm.
It wasn't as much about the connections that I was speaking to people about in that studio while I was taking their picture. It's multimedia,
right.
audio and,
mm-hmm.
and portraits. I was documenting the conversations with these people. I was documenting their experience in Kansas City and what it means to be part of these different communities and their thoughts on how Kansas City can continue this renaissance it's in and kind of the journey that it's been to get to where Kansas City is now. And I made a very conscious decision while I was in there in the process of letting this project grow organically and letting these people, these creative people, these artists, these musicians, and the patrons that, mm-hmm. and the developers who have worked within the arts community, most of them, I believe, very organically as well, to kind of take the lead.
Yeah, I love that. You know, and there has to, you have to give up some of the control in doing that to make it become more organic, mm-hmm. and sort of let it flow where it may. Were there any surprises in that happened during this time?
Well, I think it was amazing how many people had the same perspectives on Kansas City, and then how many were very differing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting. I've been talking for 3 days. I had some very intimate conversations in that room.
Mm-hmm.
You remember walking in. At first, it feels like it's subway tiled and mirrored and very white.
It felt very confessional, as though, you know, I'm going to tell you everything about myself. I'm going to just lay bare all of, you know, my facts and figures and secrets and my darkest thoughts, you know, which you know, I think I was okay with that.
Yeah, I started telling people, okay, when you first come in, it might feel a little intimidating,
mm-hmm.
and it might feel a little Spartan, I said, but eventually it starts feeling like a womb.
Yeah.
And somebody told me, I think that's Stockholm syndrome, Suzanne.
That's funny.
But I had a conversation with That's the one that stands out is with Theodis Sonny Williams. Mm-hmm. Sonny's very well known here in Kansas City and loved. He's a beautiful black homosexual man. Mm-hmm. And he creates luminaries, lamps, and which is fitting. He lit up that small room. And he was in a Josephine Baker banana skirt and beaded headdress and a pair of high heels and not much else. And that might sound a little shocking to some people listening, but he was so open and so real. And we connected, and he talked about his experiences with racism here in Kansas City and with homophobia. Mm. And at one point, I ended up in tears. And because what he didn't know before he started that conversation is that I had a grandfather on my mother's side that I never met that was a member of the KKK. Mm. And all my life, racism has been something that I've spoken out very strongly against. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the connections that I made with people and the way they were willing to open up, I guess they felt the confessional vibe too.
You know, that just lends itself to taking off in so many directions.
It does.
Is that difficult to sort of kind of rein in, okay, this is my focus, but, you know, I can also go this way. Yeah.
It was. Sometimes I had to bring conversations back to Kansas City. And sometimes my times went a little over, and a lot of people had to wait longer than they expected. But I had a couple of people walk in that were at first agitated and a little upset that they had to wait, people that I didn't know before they showed up there. Mm-hmm. And about 5 minutes in, they would all of a sudden be in that womb space and opening up to me. And I could see this change crossing their faces as I'm photographing them as well. And people would walk into the studio space in a hurry. Somebody told my husband, who was greeting everybody and helping out, my husband Oliver Gunther, who's very German and very time-oriented. And I have to say thank you to him, I think, on air right now.
He was really very wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. He enjoyed the process. But I could see that there was one man that walked in, I was getting back to that he had a cup of coffee. He was halfway done with it. And he told my husband, when the coffee's gone, so am I.
Wow.
And he came in, and I think he was there for almost half an hour. He relaxed into, he wanted to talk about Kansas City, and he wanted to talk about his relationship to it. And once people got a chance to do that, they forgot the time. And sometimes I let them. And, yeah, it got me into trouble with scheduling a couple times.
Did you have any idea that this transformation would take place with people waiting for their time on?
No. I decided to let it go organic a little bit because I could see an incredible thing happening. And then you told me you wanted to have me on, and people were saying, are you getting grants? What are you doing? What's going on? And it took on a life of its own.
Yeah.
And I think, And I don't want this to sound pre-thought out, because it's not. I'm usually pretty much stream of consciousness. I think great art should have a life of its own. If you see a painting that you love, it's because it speaks to you on its own. Mm-hmm. Or photography. Photography is, and I'm a photographer, that's the photographer's voice. And it's the photographer's vision. But it needs to speak on its own as well.
You know, and that reminds me, when people ask me, well, is this good art, or is that good art, or is that bad? You know, I think the response, you know, from me is often, well, how do you respond to it? And I think you have to kind of turn it back and have that personal experience. You know, while I was there, the gal after me had a rabbit, Meg. Did you encounter other sort of animals or things that you didn't expect?
Yes. I knew that one person beforehand was going to bring his pig, John Bursuk, who's a musician known for Bacon Shoe and a lot of very avant-garde projects, West Bottoms Pioneer. Uh-huh. I knew he had a pig, and he had told me he wanted to bring Mr. Piggles. And so, as I was talking to him in studio, I was speaking to him about his old band, Bacon Shoe, and I was like, wait a second, you have a pig on your lap. And Roger Gilbore McBride, who's also very well-known down in the Crossroads area, he's kind of an urban farmer of sorts and works with metal, large metal sculptural pieces. He's a riverboat captain. He has like a boat, and he's taken charge of the Missouri River. He says, it's my river, but I'll share with you. I knew he had chickens, and so I asked him to bring one of his chickens. Mm-hmm. So I learned that if you roll a chicken up in a towel, it travels very calmly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've had an experience with the
and
Polish
dogs.
Rooster.
There were some dogs.
Well, and you know, the Polish rooster that I used to care for, he had narcolepsy, so he was kind of interesting.
A narcoleptic rooster?
There you go.
So would he crow every time he woke up from his 30-second naps?
He just kind of would shake his head and go, where am I? Mm-hmm. And from there, where do you go? Good segue. With this project, now that it's finished, and in terms of your time here in Kansas City, where does it go from here?
Originally, I thought I was going to be going forward very much alone with it. I've told everybody it would take probably a year or 2 year and a half to bring this back to Kansas City and install it. Mm-hmm. I was worried about finding places to show it. I think that's not going to be a problem now. I think a lot of people have been making suggestions, and I think that there's probably going to be more people coming forward as they're still hearing about it.
Yeah.
The installation, I plan on it being mounted around a central location in the exhibit space. I think I want to keep it fairly intimate, the space. The audio that I recorded in conjunction with the photos, or the photos I recorded in conjunction with the conversations, as it turned out, I was photographing, documenting the conversations, I think, in the end. I will be around a central source in the room for light above, and the goal is to have fiber optics, long strands of fiber optic cables that come down from that light source, and Sean Hammontree has offered to help me with that, and a few others, I think, as well. And there will be one strand, one cable for every person within this exhibit, within this project, to connect from themselves and then to anybody else within the exhibit that they have a significant or intimate connection with within the Kansas City community that's represented there. So that in the end it'll be this glowing arterial visual with the audio behind from the conversations. And I want people to feel very included. And like they were there.
That's beautiful. I love your vision, and you know the stories. I can't wait to hear them. You know, and the photographs, because there's so many so much excitement that was generated by this project. And
You tell me, Maria. I thought that this was something that was almost going to be repetitive. I figured somebody would have done this by now. I was a little concerned. I just knew that it was what I needed to do, what I really wanted to do. And I didn't know if that was going to resonate.
Everyone has a story, you know, and everyone wants to be heard. And you've given that opportunity to 70 people, and so
maybe more. I might have to do another run of photos. I don't know yet.
Wow. Well, I do want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us. A website, you have information how to get in contact with you if you want to learn more about this project or that.
I do. The best way is to go to my Facebook photo site, and that's www.facebook.com backslash SUZANNEGUENTHERFOTOS.
Very good. Again, thank you so much for this wonderful project that brought the community together. And I want to wish you a safe travel back to Germany.
Thank you, friend.
And that was Suzanne Gunther, who I interviewed right before she left, the day before she left to return to Germany. I want to thank so many of our guests today. Thanks to John Ferry, Jonah Criswell, Brett Chenoweth, and Hector Casanova, plus Suzanne Gunther. Thank you so much for allowing me to interview you and sharing your work with the community and information that that affects us all. Next week, January 20th, on tap for ArtSpeak Radio, Celia Reese, Diane Burkholder, who's the founding member of the One Struggle KC. Celia is a community organizer. Also, artist Isaac Tapia will be on the show. Plus, we also have Ashley Lindemann, Megan Dohun, and artist Marette Miller from the Graduate Art History Association at UMKC. Stay tuned next for Jazz in the Afternoon with Jeff Harshbarger, but I will be filling in for him. That's at 1 o'clock. At 3 o'clock, Old G's Hangout with Groovy Grant. Then at 6 o'clock, we have All Souls Forum. And then after that, we have American Roots at 7 o'clock. 9 o'clock is the Classical Challenge. Thank you so much for tuning in to ArtSpeak Radio, making us a priority. Honey, I'm coming home.